Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, join us as we explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with today's key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. It's Tuesday, the 19th of November, and on the program today, will government's early retirement plan truly provide a sustainable solution to the high public sector wage bill? We'll find out where South Africa ranks in terms of global digital competitiveness, how internet and fiber services can be rolled out to underserved communities, and the launch of a new hub focusing on helping Africa catch up to global artificial intelligence advancement. Now, you might be aware that the Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, has introduced an early retirement initiative aimed at reducing the public sector wage bill, with 11 billion rand set aside over the next 2 years to facilitate this. But here's the question. Is it a step towards real reform or just a temporary fix? I want to get a grip on this with Dr. Andrew Donaldson, Senior Research Associate at the Southern African Labour and Development Research Unit at the University of Cape Town. And Andrew, first of all, then, what's your view? Is this a sustainable solution?
Hello, Jeremy. Well, I think the first thing to say is this is a blunt instrument and it doesn't tell us anything about what functions are going to be retired or amended or reformed, what parts of government are going to be reorganized, what the things are that the Treasury thinks should be defunded in order to enable core public services to be properly funded. And that's the problem when you're in a position of fiscal consolidation. You've been in that position for a long time. The Treasury has been doing work on expenditure reviews of, as I wrote in my little note, over 200 expenditure reviews conducted over the last decade or so. It should be able to tell us now what it is that needs to change in public service delivery. And an instrument like this doesn't do that. It essentially relies on people to volunteer, to take early retirement. It's very hard to avoid your more experienced and qualified people saying, well, now's the right time to step into another career. And so the risk is you lose the people you don't want to lose, and you don't actually end up saving any money because you've got to replace them.
And that's the critical risk, as you rightly say. It's retention of critical skill, cutting costs on the one hand. If I'm hearing you correctly, it's not really practical or difficult to be practical about retaining expertise, but at the same time encouraging early retirement, because a lot of people will just say, well, you know, show me the money.
Yes, and let's give a practical example. I mean, we all know we need a lot more engineers in municipalities, and that's, well, you're not going to solve that problem by offering early retirement to people. You solve that problem by recruiting engineers, and there may well be parts of the local government, municipal public service that needs to be phased out or restructured. I certainly think that's possible. I can give lots of examples. I write about the CETAs, for example, which seem to me to be 21 organizations we could well do without, and we should concentrate our resources on improving colleges, which provide vocational education, not this rather strange intermediated skills funding system. But the real point simply is, you know, analyze what needs to be done and make decisions. As Trevor Manuel always used to say, you know, government is about making choices, and you're not really making choices if you're offering a blunt instrument like this that can be taken up right across the public service.
Andrew, I'm wondering if you could sharpen that blunt instrument, though. Is there a flip side to the argument? We're sitting with a 45% youth unemployment rate at the moment. Many of those young South Africans are suitably qualified. Does this not perhaps open the pipeline for new blood?
Well, let's take a practical example of what might be done for youth employment. The presidential employment stimulus introduced in 2020 created 250 to 300,000 jobs for young people in schools, assisting teachers with early foundational reading and mathematics teaching, better security in schools, recreational and sporting activities in the afternoons. That's 300,000 jobs a year. And this year, the program's not going to happen because the Treasury decided to try to fund it in some peculiar way through the UIF, and it turns out not to be possible to do it that way. That is a huge blunder. We all need to be saying, that's a program that works. Keep going with it. It's a small fraction of the overall education budget, and it contributes to better activities in schooling, in addition to giving young people their first work opportunity. That's the sort of thing we should be talking about.
A lot of this is driven by entities like the National Skills Fund and also the plethora of CETAs that we have. I know that there's going to be a review as far as that particular process is concerned. Would reform in that particular respect make these programs more effective and therefore, again, open the pipeline for the right people coming through to do the right jobs, if you understand what I mean?
Yes, well, the Skills Fund has been reviewed several times before. The Treasury itself has done some reviews. I think all the evidence points to the fact that this is an ineffective way of promoting training. The CETAs themselves are quite expensive bureaucracies. I think that the whole act should be abandoned. And I'll tell you what the problem with the Skills and CETA system is. It organizes oversight of training on a sectoral basis. But vocation education, businesses are not organized that way. Businesses don't need to be reporting to an operation in Johannesburg or Pretoria that looks after the training needs of the entire sector. Businesses need to talk to their local colleges. They need to be engaged with the curriculum development in the colleges, and many of them are in the private sector, but there are public and private sector colleges. Western Cape here, for example, we have excellent training facilities in the film and video environment and in advertising. We have the best chef training programs in the country. That's the partnerships between businesses and local colleges are the key to better training development. Abandon the CETAs. You don't want to organize these things sectorally.
Can I bring it back to the original premise of our conversation, which is this early retirement initiative? They want to chop off a huge amount of money from the bloated public sector wage bill. If early retirement is not necessarily the answer, is there a better way to do it? Is there another instrument at our disposal?
Well, I think the first starting point is this idea of a bloated civil service. Our public employment is not all that high by international comparison relative to the overall economy, and it has not grown faster than overall employment or the economy over the last decade or so. And in many areas, policing, health services, education, we need more people, not less. But then you have to look at the salary structure. And I think the minister has rightly put under the spotlight the structure of pay in the medical field, in the health field, where the dispensations which were introduced 15 years ago have turned out to be quite expensive. And let's also be honest, we can't afford the kind of things that Parliament we're told about to do, which is raise the salaries of cleaning staff in Parliament to levels that are higher than those of nurses or policemen. Well, that is just a terrible mistake. And so you do have to put the spotlight on the remuneration system, and you've got to find the things that need to be fixed. And a blunt instrument like a general early retirement package just isn't part of that menu, it seems to me.
Momentarily, Andrew, I was getting very excited about the prospect of early retirement, but you've hit me over the head with a blunt instrument. Thank you very much for talking to me. Do appreciate your time. That's Dr. Andrew Donaldson, Senior Research Associate at the Southern Africa Labour and Development Research Unit based at the University of Cape Town.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Considering an electric vehicle, you're not alone. In just over a decade, half of all cars sold globally will be electric, and South Africa is catching up. With government subsidies on the way and the launch of the first electric minibus, the future is looking electric. For expert insights into the advantages and challenges of EVs, tune into The Current, an Investec Focus Radio essay podcast. Get informed and make the best choice for your next ride.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Digital competitiveness is becoming a critical determinant of economic power. However, as the 2024 IMD World Digital Competitiveness Ranking reveals, significant disparities persist between nations. While Singapore, Switzerland, and Denmark lead the global rankings, other economies are facing challenges in adapting to rapid technological changes and addressing digital infrastructure gaps. To discuss the findings and the implications, I'm joined now by Jose Calabero, who is senior economist at the IMD World Competitiveness Center. And first of all then, Jose, welcome. And what do we mean, and maybe this is a good place to start the conversation, by digital competitiveness?
What we assess through this digital competitiveness concept is the capacity of an economy to either develop or adopt new technologies, which lead to a transformation in all levels of society. That what that means is government, private sector, and society in general. Now, how we do it is through a structure of three factors. So the first factor is one that it refers to knowledge. If the economy produces the knowledge necessary to understand or adopt technologies, the second factor is technology. This captures the role of the framework of regulation. It also the capital available. And the final factor is future readiness. Future readiness means how well this technology and knowledge have been combined to prepare society for digital transformation. Now, within these three factors, we have nine sub-factors, and then we use 59 indicators that go into these nine sub-factors.
Right.
We use different types of indicators. We have hard statistics. We use 38 indicators, and then we use 21 survey-based indicators. The weighting of these two different types of data is 2/3 for hard statistics and 1/3 for survey. In the study, we covered 67 countries this year.
There's no doubt, Jose, that it is very comprehensive. Could you explain to me then the top three countries, which are Singapore, Switzerland, and Denmark, what are they doing to maintain their leading positions?
To begin with, there is no one way to develop digital competitiveness. Let's put it that way. There's no one model. Each country exploits its own resources available, right? So its own strength. So, for example, Singapore has a very balanced approach to digitalization or digital transformation, right? In terms of knowledge, technology, and readiness, it ranks high in all these three aspects. Switzerland is the same. You know, very balanced approach, except that Switzerland puts a lot more emphasis on knowledge, particularly the development of talent in its system of education. In the case of Denmark, it's a little bit different. Although they're very good in knowledge, and especially in talent, the emphasis is on how well the regulation support the development and adoption of technologies. So it's a little bit of a mix of how you do it. And like I said, there is no one model to reach higher levels of digital transformation.
That makes perfect sense. Are you able to explain to me then what specific difficulties or hurdles developing countries face in bridging that digital divide?
This is a very difficult question, to be honest, because we cannot, the problem is hypothetically, right? Is the adoption of technology, right? Or society, let's put it that way. Society is falling behind in terms of the use of new technologies. We can say that retailing, in online retailing, is low in a particular economy, right? So that's kind of a proxy for the adoption of technologies, right? So this might be the result of several causes, right? So, for example, in this case, it might be that people do not have the skills to use the technology. Right. Maybe it's not, they're not being taught in school, digital capabilities are not very well established in the educational system. It might be the result of lack of capital. It might be the result of, the framework, the technological framework, the technology, let's say internet is not accessible in the whole of the country. Right. So it is very difficult to pinpoint as a general rule, right? Once we get into specific countries, then, we can notice which factors are driving this kind of falling behind in digital transformation.
But whichever way you look at it, the paradigm is changing. And I'd be interested to know how emerging technologies like artificial intelligence are influencing or are going to influence a country's digital competitiveness.
Well, yes. I mean, the problem is that these technologies, all these new technologies are likely to increase the gap between developing and developed countries, right? I mean, countries that can invest in new technologies obviously will lead the way in countries that are depending on the development of technology elsewhere will fall behind, right? We see it in the use of artificial intelligence, right? In most of the developed world, largely the private sector has quickly adopted this technology, right? They're using it to increase their efficiency, for example, right? Productivity. Now, the problem is that these technologies are also likely to increase the gap within countries and between countries. In other words, let's say that artificial intelligence is adopted by a company. They increase the productivity by 10%. And then you see that people will have to be relocated or transferred to another positions because they become obsolete in certain positions, right? Now, some companies will be able to do this. Other companies cannot. The other problem will be, do we have programs that allow people to reskill, upskill their capabilities, right? In countries where such programs do not exist, now that might be a problem, right? So we're talking about a major impact on the workforce. And this is with the developed world in mind. Now, developing countries might be a little bit more likely to experience these kind of disruptions.
Just a final question, if I may. I notice as well that the report also references the importance of public-private partnership in enhancing a nation's position in the rankings. How important is that?
Oh, this is key. One of the fundamentals of digital transformation is what we call a knowledge transfer or spillovers. In other words, let's say the academic sector or the research and development sector is where ideas come from. The private sector is the where ideas are materialized or commercialized. And in this spillover kind of knowledge transfer, the role of government is fundamental, right? Not only by providing capital, but also by providing regulation that encourages research and development or, that developed the right kind of talent. And in that sense, the better the function of this relationship between private and public partnerships, the more likely is that an economy will find a smoother a path toward digital transformation.
I'm going to leave it there. The report certainly is a wealth of vital information. Jose Caballero, Senior Economist at the IMD World Competitiveness Center, thank you very much indeed for your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
In a 2023 general household survey, Stats SA revealing that only 14.5% of South African households have access to fixed internet, with the highest penetration in the Western Cape. Despite the progress, though, low-income communities still face challenges, particularly the high cost of mobile data, which often exceeds the affordability of fibre. Shane Chorley is the Chief Executive Officer of Frogfoot Networks, and he believes that rolling out sustainable high fibre connections to these communities is not only feasible, but imperative. And he joins me on the programme now. And Shane, firstly then, what then are the main difficulties in providing affordable high-speed internet access to underserved communities in the country?
Look, I mean, I think first and foremost, in providing reliable connectivity into these communities, there's obviously a costing element that we have to be able to overcome in order to provide the services at a reasonable rate that can be consumed by end users and they can actually afford it. So I think that would be the first challenge. And we've gone large strides in actually achieving that in multiple ways that I think we will continue with talking about today. The other challenges that exist are really challenges within the communities where we work with these communities. And most probably the most particular challenge that we have is that throughout the communities, there are relevant different forums within those communities that ultimately would like to participate in the program. And due to the cost of how we actually have to deploy, not everybody, you know, can actually participate in those programs. So we do get caught up in some community forums, but I think to a large extent, we're slowly starting out, you know, we're working our way through those challenges. Mm-hmm. And with the community's help, they assist us to get through those challenges.
It's always the human factor, isn't it? How can one be more incorporative then in this respect?
The way that we've structured our program and getting into these communities, what we believe, it's a full ecosystem where we really believe that we engage with the communities and employ locals from within the communities to be part of the program. And I think that's really the only way of achieving it.
One of the other issues, aside from the human factor, is cost, which I'm going to assume is a major barrier for many households. Are there more innovative or imaginative processes, Shane, that can be taken to ensure that these services remain affordable for low-income communities?
Yeah, I think as all the fiber operators, we've really driven the costs down significantly. And there really are two factors that influence the cost. The first factor is the network build side. So if you can imagine building the actual network, there's a cost attached to that. And then the second thing is the adoption from the community, because as you can imagine, the more users that are on the network, the easier it is to actually overcome the costing challenges on the network.
Is there anything specific that the Western Cape is doing? Because I read that it is leading in fixed internet access.
I think the biggest thing that the Western Cape has in an advantage, it has highly densely populated, you know, low-income areas. And from a simple build cost point of view, the more densely populated an area, the more affordable we can make the network side and ultimately delivering, you know, more affordable packages to end users. I think the other thing that the Western Cape has done extremely well is that from a government and a local municipality point of view, they've been very forthcoming in assisting the fiber operators in attaining wayleaves and actually dealing with the community challenges that we have.
I would suggest to you that there's high density in Johannesburg, for instance. So it's not just that, surely it's about policy.
Correct. That was why I mentioned my second point around the fact them assisting us with actually getting wayleaves in place and assisting us with the communities.
So what specifically are they doing in that respect to ease the passage?
Yeah, they just work with us a lot closer in order to actually work with those communities and assist us to, as fiber operators, not to overbuild each other. So they're very specific in where we can build and how we build. And they've been quite forthcoming in actually promoting, you know, where to build and how to build it.
What about advancements in fiber technology itself and then the enablement to more efficient and widespread connectivity? I presume that's happening exponentially.
Yes, I think it is happening exponentially. The only thing I want to mention on that is that ultimately fiber is sort of, it is fiber, you know, like there's no real huge advancement on the actual fiber tech that can be changed. But what we've done as a community is we've significantly changed the deployment of fiber. So simple examples are, you know, when we first started to roll out fiber into a number of homes, we obviously used the trench technology, which ultimately, you know, we had to actually go and trench either side of the road and dig into people's driveways and along the road. Throughout most of these communities that we're now deploying, we use aerial technology, which is definitely a lot more cost effective. There are some long-term downsides of it, but you know, from a cost point of view, it really allows us to deploy fast and a lot cheaper than in previous deployments.
And Shane, what about the cooperative relationship between the fiber providers and the internet service providers? How can the two of you work together to improve the whole process among the communities that you serve?
Yeah, Jeremy, that's a critical part of this this puzzle that we put together, and our ISPs are effectively our go-to-market strategy to all the end users, and there's a lot of things that they can do in order to improve the service and improve the adoption. And I think For me, there's sort of one major thing, and that is the full education of, you know, what we are actually deploying into homes in these communities, because it's vastly different to what people are used to. You know, previously they used to receive all their data via mobile, and now in these communities we have devices that go into every single home. And as an example, those devices, that's just an enabler in order to deploy internet into that home. But education about how to use it, how to recharge, and how to share it with the home, because it's no longer, you know, only your device that actually has access to the internet, but it actually gives the whole home access. And it's access to the internet in an uncapped manner. So there's no caps on data or additional bills you're going to receive if somebody downloads a huge file or whatever the case may be. It's completely uncapped. So I think education from the ISP point of view is so critical. And then finding ways on how to subsidize some of the packages through various mechanisms, whether it be paid for advertising, whether it be, you know, sponsorships, whether it be CSI funding. There's just numerous ways that ISPs can become innovative in order to ultimately get internet into people's hands.
Just a final and a quick one. Is there any way of measuring the social and economic impact of services on local communities? In other words, how their lives are improving for the better?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And it's something that we grapple with on a daily basis, because there's not really an exact way of doing it. But, you know, what we can see is as we see the adoption into these communities and the users using the services more and more, and particularly the throughput of the services increasing, sort of gives us the feeling that users in the communities are using these services for things that generate revenue. So whether you become a teacher that can educate from home, whether you are working for Amazon from home because now you are able to do that, or if you are just simply a student that's consuming more education at home. So we really believe that we are making a difference into these communities, but your question around how we actually measure it, difficult one, and we're not 100% sure exactly how to do that.
I'm going to leave it there. Shane Chorley, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of Frogfoot Networks. Shane, thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Artificial intelligence is rapidly transforming industries and societies worldwide. However, this continent's participation in the technological revolution has been limited, raising concern about Africa's role in the global AI landscape. To address this now, the University of the Witwatersrand is establishing the Machine Intelligence and Neural Discovery Institute, and it's aiming to advance AI research and innovation tailored to Africa's unique challenges and opportunities. And joining me now is Professor Benjamin Rossman, director of the Mind Institute. He's also professor in the School of Computer Science and Applied Mathematics at the university. Professor, welcome. And what then is the big problem that you're setting out to solve?
So the Mind Institute is here to make sure that Africans are involved in developing the next generation of AI tools. You know, when most people talk about that they're kind of in quotes doing AI, what they're really doing is taking existing off-the-shelf tools and applying them to their problems. But AI in itself, artificial intelligence, is kind of a field of scientific study. And it's our belief that we really need Africans to be involved in developing the next generation of kind of AI technologies and tools before they become applied into different domains as well.
So in that respect then, Professor, are there specific needs, difficulties, challenges unique to the African context that the Mind Institute is aiming to tackle?
Yes, definitely. Actually, firstly, before I go into that, one of the important aspects that we're looking at is we're not just looking at artificial intelligence, but intelligence itself, whether that's in humans, machines, animals, or any kind of natural domain. So we're bringing together experts from different fields, ranging from neuroscience and neuroanatomy to psychology to philosophy, people looking at ethics, looking at the evolution of brains and all these different aspects to give us a very interdisciplinary angle on the problem. And the kinds of things that we're really interested in pursuing, firstly, are, you know, there's questions around how do we get the AI technologies that everyone's looking at, how do we make sure that that's usable by everybody? And one of the challenges there is that, you know, it's really difficult to run a lot of these large AI models. We've got all the big tech companies are building these huge data centers that cost them millions of dollars to keep running. There's huge amounts of carbon emissions, ridiculous amounts of data required. And so one of the big questions that we're investigating is around how do you build these things to be more efficient in terms of data, in terms of electricity, in terms of really all the things that we care about.
So in that respect, then, what kind of role do you see yourself playing in shaping actual policy?
So the policy question is very interesting. And again, I think it talks to having a strong cohort of technical people that are sitting in the continent. So there are a lot of people that are getting involved in the policy discussions. But what's really important to us is that we've got this kind of interdisciplinary group of experts. So we've got the people that are working deeply in developing the technology. We've got people that understand how the technology is being applied. We've got people that are thinking about the impact on society. We've got people thinking about the ethics and then the policy. And with this kind of cohort of these researchers and academics all coming together, that means we're thinking about questions from all angles. So from the policy perspective, what that means is that when we set policies, they've got to be in line not just with the reality of how modern AI works, right? Because these are really fast-changing technologies. So we have to kind of think about how could the technology be developing into the future? Are the policies we're setting robust against these changes? And are they best suited to kind of serve our people in a positive way?
Are you confident that the skill set exists in this country across all of those different touch points to actually make a real difference?
Definitely. So this is something that's been very exciting while we've been pulling this institute together. At the core, we've got 34 academic fellows from across WITS. And part of the idea was that by bringing all these people together, that gives us a kind of critical mass. You know, if there's one or two people that are just working on a problem, it's very hard to be forward thinking because you're spending all your time dealing with, you know, the various challenges that we have to deal with. But the second you've got a large number of people that are thinking about similar kinds of problems, that are working together, forming quite a tightly knit community, that's when really the benefits of everyone's specialties gets to shine out. And the fellows that we've got here really draw from absolutely every aspect of the university, ranging from computer science to psychology to the creative arts to engineering to anatomy. And bringing these people together and realizing that many of them have been thinking about similar kinds of questions just in different guises has been really inspiring, because they've been able to talk the same language. And this means that we've got so many different people, right? These are just the academics, but each one has a lab, has students, has other colleagues. And so this is turning out to be a huge multiplier of the kind of force that we have across the university.
I would imagine with the work that you do, ethics is a given, but how difficult is it going to be to tether the work to make sure that you remain culturally relevant?
Well, I think this is very difficult at the best of times, but if you're sitting in a situation where you've just got, you know, your computer scientists and engineers making these decisions, as happens in most places in the world, as a computer scientist myself, I don't think we're the ones who should be left to make all the ethical decisions. But because we've got ethicists and philosophers and so on, this then gives us a bit of a secret weapon to kind of talk to these kind of ethical guidelines and principles and frameworks that have been considered for hundreds of years in different schools of thought that, you know, maybe many of the people that are just otherwise pushing the technology are unaware of. And so if we have these kinds of people, we've got social scientists and so on, that then gives us all these touch points with society in different ways. And I think, again, I think that's what's needed to make sure that we really build technology that is is there to be maximally beneficial to society.
And just a final one, Professor, it can be very time consuming, and I say this with all respect, when a group of academics get together and start to work on something. The important thing here is that you have an immediate short-term impact. What would you like to see that be?
I think one thing there is that this is one of the advantages to universities, is that we can think long-term where maybe industry can't. So typically, you know, a company can't take a 4 or 5 year bet on something that may or may not pan out. But we can do this at universities because we're also in the business of giving degrees. And, you know, we encourage our students to explore and ask different questions. But coming to what we're trying to do here, you know, we've already established this group of fellows. We've already started meetings between them. And what we're trying to do is encourage rapid innovation of new ideas. And so already what we've seen really just in the last month of having the fellows is new collaborations and new ideas coming out. And so what we're hoping to see is even early next year, a whole new swath of kind of interesting research ideas, papers, white papers to start forming out. And any that are kind of looking promising are ones we can double down on, invest more in, and hopefully turn into something that has impact in society.
Looking forward to seeing some of that output. Professor Benjamin Rossman, thank you very much indeed. Director of the Mind Institute and also professor in the School of Computer Science and Applied Mathematics at Wits University. Thank you so much for your time today. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.